How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
The family moved into their dream house in December of 1975. It was an amazing place, much larger than they ever believed they'd be able to afford. It was in an upscale neighborhood on Long Island with a big yard, a boathouse, and even great schools for the three kids. But from almost the moment they moved in, the family started to notice there was something strange about the place, as if they weren't in the house alone. And they started to wonder if maybe there had been a good reason why the house was so cheap. At first, it wasn't much, they'd later report in a best-selling book. Just some mysterious sounds and some locked doors and windows that opened on their own. Not much, sure, but it did enough to unnerve the family. They asked a local priest to stop by and bless the place. He did, but it didn't go well. According to that book, he heard a disembodied voice that told him to get out of the house. And unknown to the family at the time, he was pursued by something back to his rectory, where he was attacked by hundreds of flies and nearly died from some strange illness. And things got worse after that. The thumping and scratching sounds ramped up, becoming louder and more frequent, joined by cold chills, strange odors, and moving objects. Some kind of green slime started oozing from the walls. Clouds of flies appeared from nowhere. Their telephone repeatedly disconnected whenever they tried to call for help. One of the children began to have contact with some sort of devil pig. The mother was beaten and scratched by invisible hands and once even levitated off the bed. And the father was possessed by some sort of evil spirit that caused his personality to change. Eventually, it was more than they could stand, and after 28 days, they fled the house, leaving all their furniture and many of their possessions behind. The family, too terrified to return to the house, finally sought help for themselves in their horrifically haunted house, and in February of 1976, people across America first began to hear about their 28 days of terror. And everything we all thought we knew about ghosts and hauntings in the 1970s was changed forever. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the final episode of season 8, a season we called Home. The finale is written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. And is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. This season, we went on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crime gone by. We went behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence left lingering ghosts behind. We saved this house for last, one that is certainly not little-known. In fact, it may be one of the most haunted houses in American history. Or is it? I guess that'll be up to you to decide. We'll present the story and the evidence, and you can decide for yourself what you'd like to believe. This is episode 23 of the season, Amityville, Horror or Hoax? I'm sure that most of our listeners recognize the story I open this episode with, the bare bones of the Amityville horror story. To tell the story of this once very famous haunted house seems like it should be simple, but oh, it's not. In fact, there's nothing simple about this story at all. It's a story that actually has three parts and takes a couple of side trips too, revealing some eye-opening facts about some other famous hauntings. Now, I won't try and convince you that everything you'll hear in this episode is the truth. Don't get me wrong, it was reported as the truth, but the jury's still out when it comes to some aspects of everything you're about to hear. But I'm not going to tell you what to believe. I get it. Every story gets started for a reason. I mean, even if that reason is greed. But believe it or not, there is much about this story that has the potential to be the truth. Well, what part of it? Well, I guess we'll see. My fascination with the story of the Amityville Horror goes back to when it happened in the 1970s. I was barely a teenager when the book about the case written by Jay Anson was released, and I read it over and over again, utterly fascinated. The cover of the book assured me that it was a true story, which made it one of the most terrifying things I'd ever read. The Amityville Horror became one of the best-selling books of the 70s and convinced a lot of people that demons and malevolent hauntings were real. And maybe they are, but was what readers found in the pages of that book real? Well, there are a lot of questions about that, especially after it was later revealed by one of the people involved that the stories were concocted with the help from a few bottles of red wine. Well, why would they do that? What would be the point of such a massive hoax? That is a complicated question. And we'll get to that. Just know going in that, as I already mentioned, this is a story about a house that certainly had the possibility of being haunted. In fact, it might have been. But this whole thing simply spun out of control after some of those involved didn't know how to stop the mess that it all became. But let's begin at what's really the beginning. Not with the family who moved into the house in December 1975, but a year earlier, in November of 74, when Ronald Butch DeFeo brutally murdered his family inside that very same house. The house at 112 Ocean Avenue, which had been named High Hopes, was home to the entire DeFeo family in the fall of 74. The DeFeos seemed to be a happy, all-American family. Ronald Sr. had been born and raised in Brooklyn and ran a successful Buick dealership. He'd moved to the upscale town of Amityville on Long Island with his wife Louise, their sons Ronald Jr., who was known as Butch, Mark and John, and their daughters Dawn and Allison. The house was large, two stories plus an attic, several bedrooms, and a boathouse on the river. They looked like a happy family, but appearances were deceiving. His son, Butch, would later claim that his father was an angry, violent, and abusive man, and Butch said his father often took his anger out on him. As he got older, he started fighting back, and things became physical between them, turning Butch into a man as angry and violent as his father. Or so he claimed. Remember, we only have Butch's word for all of this. No one else survived to disagree with him. Butch's mother, Louise, sent him to psychiatrists, but that did little good. His parents tried to keep the peace by giving him whatever he wanted. They gave him a speedboat when he was 14, and by the time he was 17, had been kicked out of school for drugs. After that, his behavior became even more erratic. One night, he ended an argument with his father by pointing a loaded shotgun at him. So you can see why his version of events may not be completely reliable. In the weeks before the murders, things became worse between Butch and Ronald. Butch was being given a weekly allowance for helping out at his father's Buick dealership, cash he usually spent on drugs and alcohol. One night, just 2 weeks before the murders, Butch claimed that he was mugged while dropping off thousands of dollars in cash deposits for the dealership at the bank. The bandits escaped with all the money, he told his father, who called the police. When detectives questioned Butch about the robbery, he became very angry, shouting and cursing, and smashed in the hood of a car on the lot. This outburst led detectives and Ronald Sr. to believe that Butch had something to do with the robbery, perhaps had just stolen the money himself. More questions were asked, which led to another angry confrontation, followed by Butch speeding away from the dealership. Again, trying to appease his volatile son, Ronald Sr. refused to press charges or cooperate any further with the investigation. And the tension between father and son simmered for the next 10 days. The night of Wednesday, November 14th was quiet in Amityville. Everyone at 112 Ocean Avenue was asleep, except for Butch, who was brooding and pacing around in his bedroom. His hatred for his father had driven him to the point that he'd decided to solve all his problems once and for all. He had a lot of guns, which seems problematic to me in so many ways, but loaded a .35 caliber Marlin rifle, opened his bedroom door, and started walking down the dark hallway to his parents' room. Now, I'll warn you, the next few minutes are pretty graphic. Butch opened the door of Ronald and Louise's bedroom, walked in, and fired two times at his father. The first shot passed through his kidney and exited through his chest. The second shot pierced his spine and lodged in his neck. His mother was sleeping next to her husband. Butch also shot her two times, collapsing her lung. She bled to death on the bed, drowning in her own blood. The booming sounds of four rifle shots had just rang out in the house, but no one in any of the other bedrooms awakened, and the neighbors heard nothing. Butch then walked down the hall to his brother's bedroom. Mark and John shared a bedroom, and Butch fired one shot each at the two boys. Mark was killed instantly, while John, whose spinal cord was severed by the shot, bled to death. Two more gunshots had just reverberated in the house, but Butch's sisters, who shared a room nearby, heard nothing. Dawn was close in age to Butch, while Allison was in grade school with John and Mark. As Butch walked into the room, Allison stirred. He aimed the rifle at her, and she looked up at him just as he pulled the trigger. Butch then shot Dawn, who was still asleep. She hadn't been awakened by the gunshot that killed her sister, even though it occurred in the same room. It was now just after 3 a.m. In less than 15 minutes, Butch DeFeo had murdered his entire family in cold blood. After the murders, Butch calmly showered, shaved, and got dressed. He collected his rifle and bloody clothing, wrapped them in a pillowcase, and put them in the car. He then drove to Brooklyn, where he dumped the clothing and murder weapon into a storm drain, and then returned to Long Island and reported for work at the Buick dealership. When his father didn't show up for work that morning, Butch pretended to be concerned and called home several times. When no one answered his calls, he shrugged and said he'd try again later. Butch left work at noon. Before leaving, he called his girlfriend, Mindy Wise, and told her that he was coming over. On the way, he ran into a friend and stopped to chat, as if it were simply any ordinary day. After that, he went to Wendy's house and, still trying to establish the idea that he knew nothing about what had happened to his family, told her that he'd tried to call home several times but had never gotten an answer. He tried again, using her phone. Still, no one answered. Acting puzzled, but still fairly unconcerned, he met a friend at a local tavern while Mindy went shopping. He told everyone at the bar that he couldn't reach his family by phone. He decided he was going to drive over and check on them. But he returned to the bar a few minutes later in a panic, pleading for help. Someone, he cried out, had shot his entire family. Several of the tavern customers ran back to the DeFeo house with Butch, and one of them went into the house where he discovered the murdered family. The police were alerted and officers descended on the scene. The flashing lights drew the neighbors from their homes and they lined the streets when the coroner's office finally removed the bodies hours later. Detectives took Butch, the only survivor, down to the station to answer questions. At this point, it seemed possible Butch was in danger. If someone was trying to kill the DeFeos, Butch had been missed, and the killer, well, he might be back. Butch apparently liked this idea because during the questioning, Butch first told detectives that his family had been killed by a mafia hitman who had a grudge against them. His father, he claimed, was linked to organized crime. He swore several times he'd apparently slept through the murders and had left for work early that morning before anyone else would have been up. He tried calling his family all day. I mean, his friends and coworkers could vouch for that. Whether they initially believed him at first is unknown, but Butch became the lead suspect after boxes of .35 caliber bullets were found in his room. His story changed several times after that, and he forgot which lies he'd told, and his claims of a mob hit were forgotten. He eventually confessed to the murders, telling detectives, "It all started so fast, once I started, I couldn't stop." Butch's trial began on October 14, 1975, nearly a year after the murders. Butch had confessed to the crime, led detectives to where he had disposed of the gun and clothing, and his rifle was clearly the murder weapon, but Suffolk County District Attorney Gerald Sullivan was taking no chances with his prosecution. He needed to make sure that Butch went to prison. And besides that, he needed a good story because he would write his own book about the case once he saw how well the Amityville Horror did. Anyway, Sullivan dug into Butch's history with drugs and psychiatrists and knew he had mental issues, but could find no one who believed he was insane at the time of the murders. Sullivan needed to build a case that proved that Butch was capable of murder, not crazy. Butch was represented by well-known New York defense attorney William Weber, who had already tried to get the case thrown out by saying that Butch didn't have a lawyer when he confessed. Well, that failed, so he decided to try for an insanity defense. When Butch took the stand, he was well-coached to offer bizarre answers, even claiming he had murdered his family in self-defense. They were going to kill him, he claimed, if he didn't kill them first. The defense also brought in psychiatrists to testify about Butch's mental state, including Dr. Daniel Schwartz, who later went on to testify on behalf of David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Killer. But at least he wouldn't claim that Butch was told to kill his family because of orders from a dog, as he would with Son of Sam. State psychiatric experts testified that while Butch had an antisocial personality, as well as a lot of other issues, he was not insane. He understood right from wrong. The case went to the jury, and on November 21, 1975, Butch was found guilty of 6 counts of second-degree murder and received a sentence of 25 years to life. He remained behind bars until his death in March of 2021. But the guilty verdict in Butch's trial wasn't quite the end of his part in our story. It was just the beginning of a much bigger story about 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville. The DeFeo murders had made grim local news, but few people outside of New York heard about the house where they happened until more than a year after the massacre occurred. And that publicity had nothing to do with murder. On December 18, 1975, George and Kathy Lutz bought the Ocean Avenue house for $80,000. But after 28 days of being harassed by demonic events and terrifying happenings, the Lutz family fled the house, driven out by malevolent spirits. And if you think that's scary, wait until you hear what happened next. In February 1976, almost 2 months after allegedly fleeing the house in terror, George Lutz started making calls about the Amityville house. He contacted several paranormal investigators in the New York area, including Dr. Stephen Kaplan, who was then executive director of the Parapsychology Institute of America. He asked Kaplan if there was a fee to have his group come and investigate the house for supernatural activity. Kaplan said no, there was no fee, but if the story was a hoax, he wouldn't hide that from the press. Well, a few days later, George called and canceled the investigation, stating that he and his wife decided they didn't want any publicity. Kaplan wasn't surprised. He got calls like that all the time. So he was stunned a few days later when he turned on the television and saw New York Channel 5's news team doing a live feed from Amityville. Along with the news crew were two other people who had received a call from George Lutz. Ed and Lorraine Warren, America's most famous demonologists. The news crew filmed a dramatic seance in the house that night as the Warrens assured the audience that the place was haunted and that a family had recently fled the house after only living there for 28 days. Well, within days, the Amityville haunted house story started gaining traction and spreading like a runaway train across the country. Soon, though, it would go completely off the rails, and whatever truth there may have been in all this, it soon got lost in the shuffle. Now, for those not familiar with Ed and Lorraine Warren, and honestly, it seems tough to think there's anyone listening who doesn't know about them, but anyway, don't be confused by the characters that appear in the Conjuring films. They weren't Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. real life is a very different story. Lorraine Warren claimed to be a clairvoyant and trance medium with an ability to contact the next world. Her husband, Ed, was an expert on hauntings, all of which seemed to involve demons, as well as an expert on exorcism and demonology, even though he had no formal training or authority to call himself an expert on honestly much of anything. But anyway, starting in the 1950s, the Warrens became recognized authorities when it came to ghosts and haunted houses, mostly just by being in the right place at the right time. In those days, they were pretty much the only game in town. By the time the Amityville case fell in their laps, they were already very popular, especially in New England, because those people love their demons. Well, they were also making regular appearances in magazines and newspapers and on television. When Amityville came along, they were just a few years past another case that would become sensational for them many years later. That was when a movie franchise was launched and when enough years had passed that people forgot how badly they'd screwed things up in that earlier case. Now, that story had started in the winter of 1970, when Roger and Carolyn Perrin, along with their five children, moved into a charming old Rhode Island farmhouse that locals called the Old Arnold Place. When the parents first moved in, there was no indication of a spooky presence in the place, until things went missing and objects started moving around on their own. The Perrin children were the first to believe there were ghosts, who seemed harmless, but their mother would come to believe the spirits became resentful over time. One night, Carolyn said she was awakened by a very tall woman in an old gray dress with her head hanging to the side. The woman delivered the ominous warning that the parents needed to find another place to live. "Get out," she said, "or I'll drive you out with death and gloom." Carolyn researched the history of the house and found that eight generations of one family had lived there. And over all those years, it wasn't surprising that plenty of them had died on the property. She'd been looking for identities for the ghosts and, well, had plenty to choose from. Meanwhile, things at the house were getting worse. There were no more ghostly warnings, but there were plenty of physical attacks, pinches, slaps, and violent abuse. The children were often attacked, but Carolyn seemed to be the main target. She was harassed without mercy some days, and once was even stabbed by a knitting needle. And there was more, like the overwhelming smell of decaying flesh that sometimes drifted through the house. Footsteps in the halls, unexplained noises, doors that slammed open and closed, beds that lifted off the floor, and worse. The parents didn't move out of their now very frightening haunted house. They couldn't afford to. But they did seek professional help from a local paranormal research group. And it was members of the group who decided to call in the real experts, Ed and Lorraine Warren. Keep in mind, Amityville hadn't happened yet, and neither had some of the other things they used to build their reputation with in the years to come. There was no made-up story about a doll named Annabelle. They hadn't tried to get some poor kid off on murder charges by saying he was possessed by a demon, and they hadn't yet claimed that a demon caused another guy to turn into a werewolf. Completely believable stuff here, folks. Anyway, today we know that the Warrens never let the truth get in the way of a good story, but back then, people didn't know any better. And because of that, it wasn't hard for Lorraine to convince Carolyn that the ghost who wanted her out of the house was a woman named Bathsheba, who practiced witchcraft and sacrificed her baby to the devil before she hanged herself from a tree in the backyard of her house. Bathsheba wanted to possess Carolyn, the Warrens said, so she could continue her murders in the present. But there are, few small problems with this story. Bathsheba was a real woman. That part is true. She was born Bathsheba Thayer and married a man named Judson Sherman, with whom she had four children. Three of those children died in childhood from illnesses, which was unfortunately common at the time. But nothing else about what the Warrens said or what's in the movie is true. Bathsheba was not a witch, and none of her children were murdered or sacrificed to the devil. She also didn't hang herself in the backyard of the old Arnold place. She didn't die until 1885, and she was 73 years old when she did. Bathsheba, along with the rest of her family, was buried in the local churchyard, something that wouldn't have been allowed if she'd been a witch. The parent house was apparently haunted, but it wasn't haunted by Bathsheba Sherman. And whoever those ghosts were, the Warrens didn't get rid of them. In fact, they just made things worse. One night when the Warrens were at the house, Carolyn became convinced she was possessed by a spirit. During a seance conducted by Lorraine, Carolyn began speaking a strange language and, according to witnesses, levitated in a chair. By the end of the night, Roger, worried about his wife's mental health, kicked the Warrens out of the house and told them not to come back. Weird, I don't remember that part in the movie, do you? Anyway, Ed and Lorraine, of course, blamed the Perrin family for the fact that their house was still haunted. They said their lack of faith was the reason the ghosts wouldn't leave. It certainly couldn't be the Warrens' fault. Once again, different from the movie, the story didn't end there. The Perrins stayed in the house until 1980 because they couldn't afford to move out. They eventually learned to live with as many as 9 spirits, they later said. Eventually, the true story told by the Perrins about living in the old Arnold house got mixed into the stories cooked up by the Warrens, and Hollywood turned the whole thing into a popular movie and an ongoing franchise. The real elements of the haunting got lost in the shuffle, which was the same thing that happened in Amityville, because, of course, the Warrens were neck deep in that one, too. They didn't start the mess in Amityville, but they were the first to jump on the bandwagon, and then they refused to let it die. And it's no surprise they were first. The Warrens, again, were at the top of their game in early 1976. So when people tuned in to see Ed and Lorraine at the Amityville house with a news crew, they thought they were seeing the real thing. Before the show, the Warrens had borrowed a key to the house from George Lutz, who said that he and his family refused to go back inside. Most of the Lutz family belongings were still in the house, they claimed for the TV audience. There was even food in the refrigerator. It was obvious the family had left in a hurry. According to Lorraine, there was a terrible presence in the house. Ed claimed to suffer from heart palpitations from the occult forces that were present. They even took a photograph that seemed to show the ghost of a young boy looking around a corner near the staircase. Evidence that proved the house was haunted, they claimed. And who were the ghosts? Well, they knew that too. The most troublesome ghosts were the angry spirits of Native Americans who had once inhabited the area. Although I'm not clear how they could know this, they claimed the Shinnecock tribe had used the parcel of land where the house now stood for sick and insane members of the tribe to be isolated until they died. After their deaths, they were buried on land that was now, of course, under the house. It was also suggested that one of these spirits had possessed Butch DeFeo and caused him to murder his family. An addition that would become important to the story. Soon after the Warrens' television appearance, George and Kathy Lutz teamed up with a writer named Jay Anson, and together they authored what would become the best-selling book, The Amityville Horror. The book inspired a movie, and the Warrens were hired by the film's producers to serve as consultants for the picture, which is likely how the events in the film became even more outrageous than what was in the book. The Warrens also made the rounds of all the TV talk shows at the time, discussing the horrifying events in Amityville. As the movie became successful, even more books were sold. The Amityville Horror was in theaters, in bookstores, in magazines, on television, and soon was known all around the world. Ghosts were real. This proved it. Remember, it was right on the cover of the book in 3 bold words, a true story. What happened in the house on Ocean Avenue was the real thing. Right? It took a few years, but the most sensational aspects of the story began to fall apart. Before I start unraveling parts of this story, let me just say one thing. It's very possible that a house where an entire family was murdered could be haunted. I think it's possible the murders possibly even created a haunting at 112 Ocean Avenue, at least for a while. But it soon became obvious that nothing had occurred like the events that were described in the book. One of the first problems that emerged was related to the so-called history of the property itself. The Warrens had claimed the house was built on everybody's favorite trope, the Indian burial ground. But that story was denied by the Amityville Historical Society, who made it clear there was no evidence of a burial ground on the property. And not only that, It was the Montaukett Indians, not the Shinnecocks, who had settled the area. Now, this was not great, but nothing compared to what was to come. In 1979, Butch DeFeo's attorney, William Weber, confessed to his part in the Amityville horror story. Weber admitted that he had joined George and Kathy Lutz for dinner one night, and over many bottles of wine, they'd concocted the story of the haunting. Weber wanted to get a new trial for Butch, and after hearing stories about all the wild things that allegedly happened in the house, as well as that of good old Indian burial ground, he believed he could get his client back into the courtroom using what he called the "devil made him do it" defense. He didn't believe in ghosts and demons himself, but if he could make it look like Butch did, and that he believed he was possessed, Weber could reintroduce the insanity defense. And if the public believed all the hype about the house being haunted, then it would make the defense easier to sell to a jury. So Weber, along with George and Kathy, got to work and came up with a story about a priest that fled the house, sinister forces that took over the place, broken windows, doors torn off their hinges, bent locks, green slime oozing from everywhere, a crucifix that turned upside down on the wall, and a room that became infested with hundreds of flies, even though it was the middle of winter. And then, of course, there was the night George woke up to see Kathy levitating over the bed. And there was the morning when the family woke to find cloven hoof prints circling the house in the snow. They were sure it was the invisible pig with glowing red eyes that had befriended Kathy's daughter that left the footprints outside. Weber claimed that George had joined the scheme because he wanted to get out from under a mortgage he couldn't afford and had a business that was failing. He needed the money from the book to bail him out. In the end, though, things didn't work out as planned. The Lutzes may have made some money, but it didn't last. Their marriage even eventually fell apart. As for William Weber, his client died in prison, and he later filed a lawsuit against George and Kathy because they failed to pay him a promised $2 million bonus from the money they made from the book. That was eventually settled out of court. Things got worse after more events of the story began to be questioned. It wasn't hard to debunk these things, and their exposure really shouldn't have taken years to accomplish. Anyone who went into the house and looked around would have realized many of the things claimed in the book had just simply never occurred. For instance, there was no evidence ever found that the front door to the house was blown off its hinges like in the book. In fact, the extensive damage to doors, cabinets, and windows that is in the book, that never happened at all. All the old hardware, hinges, locks, doorknobs, all still in place, and there were no disturbances to the paint or woodwork. In addition, a columnist from a local newspaper, who was suspicious about the story, discovered that a few days after the family went, quote, fleeing for their lives from the house never to return, unquote, they came back to hold a garage sale. He also discovered that during their 28-day nightmare, they never once called the police for assistance, which someone almost definitely would have done under those circumstances. And one more thing. The family had claimed to find those cloven hoof prints in the snow outside the house, but there had been no snow in Amityville during the entire time they had been living there. And the church piled on, too. They stated that the role of the priest in the book was greatly exaggerated and that what was written wasn't true. A priest had come to bless the house because he did, understandably, have some concerns about the murders that occurred just over a year before. But the priest and his rectory were unharmed by any demons. There was also that sensational photo that had been taken during the Warren seance in the house. One of the ghostly little boy that many people were claiming was one of the younger DeFeo sons. Well, that boy turned out to be Paul Bartz, an investigator working with the Warrens that night. He'd been kneeling down and looked up at the camera. Light reflected on his glasses, which made his eyes look spooky. And even Butch DeFeo chimed in. At first, he stated that the house was definitely not haunted and that he was not possessed by a spirit and complained he was being exploited. He later changed his tune, though, probably looking for a piece of the fame, fortune, and money. Well, he changed his tune until he failed to get that new trial he'd been looking for. He never had much to say about anything after that. Those who purchased the house after the Lutz family moved out maintained the place was not haunted. But because of the constant problems they had with tourists and curiosity seekers, they sued the hardcover and paperback publishers of the Amityville Horror, as well as Jay Anson and George and Kathy Lutz. That suit was also later settled out of court. Subsequent owners who removed the familiar half-moon windows on the front of the house and even changed the street address continue to have problems, but not from ghosts or demons. The tourists, or as the people in the community like to call them, the Amityville Horribles, never went away. And that was because the story never went away. Despite the confessions, the story's plot holes, and hard evidence that proved little described in the book could have happened, the legend of the Amityville Horror continued to grow, making it one of the most haunted houses in history, one that was probably never as haunted as anyone claimed. Or was it? I mean, what really happened at Amityville? Well, not as much as the book claimed, or as much as Ed and Lorraine Warren told everyone, since they always claimed the story was absolutely true, and how could they not? By the time many parts of the story were debunked, the couple were so deep into it, they couldn't get out. Ignoring the confessions and the evidence that showed their version of events weren't true, the Warrens both continued to claim the haunting was genuine until their deaths. Kathy died in 2004, and George died 2 years later, continuing to do interviews about the house until the end. Unlike William Weber, George continued to claim that most of the story was true, although he admitted that some of the details had been embellished and invented, but only by the media and the Warrens and other people, not by himself or Kathy. Which again makes us ask, was any of his story true? As I already said, the house certainly had the potential to be haunted, based on what had happened there before the Lutz family moved in. It's also worth noting that both George and Kathy Lutz took lie detector tests and passed, supporting at least some of their claims of what happened in the house, if we accept the reliability of polygraph tests anyway. Toward the end of his life, George was still claiming the events were real, although he backtracked a little and admitted that while the place was haunted, it may not have been quite as haunted as the book had made it seem, but there may have been more to it than that. Some houses are haunted by ghosts, while others are haunted by secrets. There was another thing the family experienced in the house, perhaps more frightening than green slime and ghost pigs. And that was George's deteriorating mental health. His mood after moving in quickly changed. He started yelling at the kids and at Kathy. Sometimes these bursts of temper became physical. The couple had only recently gotten married, but Kathy said she'd never seen George act that way before. At one point, he beat all three of the children with a strap and a heavy wooden spoon. But he had little to say about that in those final interviews. He would only admit that they didn't flee the house in terror, but had moved out because the place was so oppressive that he fell into a deep depression that changed his personality. He blamed that personality change on the ghosts. The evil in the house had driven him to violence, he said. It was easier to blame it on the spirits than to blame it on the fact that he didn't get the help he needed when he should have. The story of the Amityville Horror will always be a mystery, perhaps because there are so many things about it that we don't really know. It's been studied and dissected many times over the years, but I've always wondered why we all believe the story so easily at the time when the book came out. It could have been something about American culture at the time, I guess. I mean, there had recently been a rise in interest in the occult, which came on the heels of films like The Exorcist and The Omen, and we were also on the verge of the Satanic Panic, a nationwide hysteria during which millions of Americans became convinced, without any evidence, that devil worshipers had infiltrated every part of our lives. Now, that sounds a lot like believing, again, without any real evidence, that the Amityville Horror story was real. I mean, were we confused? I don't know. Maybe. Naive? Sure. Or maybe we were just stupid. If so, then that stupidity has stuck around. because there's still an awful lot of people out there who are convinced that everything in the book actually happened. That's how deeply ingrained the Amityville horror is in our history of American hauntings. And the reason why it couldn't leave it out of this season, whether it's fiction or whether there's a small chance that some of it might be true. But that's crazy, right? I mean, I'm sure most of us feel that way. I'm sure many of you listening think the things in this episode are nuts. Demons, ghost pigs, levitations. I mean, come on. You could get behind ghost stories, but this kind of stuff can't be real. But not so fast. I agree that it's clear that most of the elements that have become part of the Amityville legend are fake. I'd even concede that elements from just about any story in this season could be untrue. I struggle to believe in some things, just like many of you do. But let's stick with Amityville. What if there is more truth to some parts of the story than we want to admit because we're so overwhelmed by the things that didn't happen that we overlook the things that did? That's spooky to think about, right? I mean, that's something that you can think about tonight when you're home, when you turned off all the lights and get into bed, and you start to hear that scratching sound in the darkness. I'm sure it's just a tree branch scratching at the window. I wouldn't worry. I'm sure there's nothing out there that's going to get you. Thanks for listening to this season, guys, and stay with us for the rest of the show after enjoying these important messages from our sponsors.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Good to go when you are, man.
Okay. All right. Let me fix the microphone. Okay. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 23, our last episode of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this over a spaghetti dinner and a few bottles of wine. You'd be surprised to know that the more I drink, the better the podcast is. Actually, that is absolutely not true, as my friend, co-host, producer, and editor, Cody Beck, and I can both tell you firsthand that is not true.
There are some episodes that I'll probably just purge at some point.
Yeah, at some point, there's a couple that need to be deleted.
You're right. Yeah, because you know how this day and age is different, but you know, my parents used to say, you know, don't put stuff out on the internet, people won't hire you, blah, blah, blah. That's some of those episodes just don't show us in our best light.
So they really don't. We probably should just like figure out which ones are really bad and just re-record them or something.
Yeah.
Just take off the last half where we're talking.
Maybe. Well, I believe I'm not going to tell which one it is, but
no.
But yeah, one's a special episode, so we just have to delete the whole thing.
There was
moonshine involved, if you remember.
Oh, gosh, I remember.
Yes.
Well, vaguely. So yeah, it was just bad. So
from my days as a drinking man. But okay. Yeah. But yeah, well, I'm glad that you got all this out, you know, regardless if there was wine involved or not.
No, there really wasn't. I just thought it was funny.
No, so. It's hilarious. man, we made it through another season.
I know. Hard to believe that we made it and we're gearing up for the next one.
We will, you know, do as we've always done, give everybody a sneak preview right before it starts. But it's we already know what it's going to be. Even Cody has a pretty good idea of what it's going to be already. Pretty he doesn't good. Know about the Patreon yet, which I'm getting ready to do the teaser for that here very soon, actually. And then, you know, we'll be kicking off our next episode after the holidays, or next season after the holidays, rather.
Yeah, we, you know, I'm thinking about how it all started. We had shorter seasons now, and then it graduated to a season going a year, and then we just kept plowing through no matter what. And we were like, you know what? Everybody deserves a break.
Well, yeah, we needed a break at the holidays, but we also found that no one was listening.
Exactly. So,
and then we found out that everybody does that. Almost every show takes a break at the holidays. And so we thought, that's probably our best plan.
Right.
So we'll have our special movie episode coming up. Next week. We'll have to get on that. So
next Tuesday is when it is.
Yeah. Yeah. We usually put that out just a week after our last episode here.
Got it.
That way, because otherwise it'd be Christmas Eve and no one would hear it. So we need to do it the week before. So anyway, we'll be coming up with that next week and talking about our favorite horror movies of the year and just generally goofing around.
Yes.
What we normally do.
And
an episode, but it is fun.
So. Yeah, and while the podcast is taking a break, you still got a lot of other stuff in the works and going on.
What's up? There's tons of stuff. Well, my new book's out, so if anybody wants something to do, that's going to take longer than just the holidays.
The cover looks amazing.
If you've not seen the book, it is it's pretty big, almost as long as the subtitle, because the subtitle is very long. But you could shorten it to The Secret History of America's Circuses and Carnivals. So it's the circus, midways, carnivals, sideshows, freak shows, circus disasters, crime stories, and ghosts, all in one massive book.
Yeah.
The longest book I've ever written. So
really?
If you're into that kind of stuff, yeah, I think you'll like this one. So hopefully you can check it out. You can order it online or if you're in the area. I am doing another book signing at the American Oddities Museum this coming Saturday, December 14th, starting at noon. We had that, you know, Small Business Saturday thing on November 30th, and the weather kind of screwed us over because we ended up with like a freak early snowstorm. So, which on top of everything else lately, I honestly kept thinking, okay, I'm cursed. That's it. Mm. We're cursed. But
it's because the faith thing, you know?
Well, we had a pretty good turnout anyway. So, but if you didn't get there and maybe you stayed home and you thought maybe it would be cool to have the new book or any of the books signed and give them to somebody on your holiday list, come see me on the 14th. I'll be there all day at the museum. And if nothing else, just come by, hang out, see the museum. We've added a lot of new stuff. As we've started to say, if you haven't been there in a while, then you've never been there at all, because that's how much this place has changed. So anyway, that'll be coming up. And after that, you know, in addition to the new season and stuff, I mean, tickets are going to go on sale for the conference coming up on January 6th. The vendor booths are already available, and they're already half sold out. They just went on sale last week, and already people have scooped them up. So if you were hoping to be a vendor this year, you may want to get on it while we still have stuff left. And then, of course, the next thing that we do will be Dead of Winter on February 1st, which is going to be here before we know it. That's our annual food drive. So canned goods, non-perishable stuff. We're going to be benefiting the Alton Food Bank and the Warming Center. We will be holding this one at the Best Western Premier Hotel. I've got just a couple of vendor spots left. I've got after hour events that are filling up. One of them's already sold out. And I've got just very few spots left for the VIP lunch package, just a couple of spots. And then the other VIP package also pretty low there too. Mostly just, you know, those are reserved seating. The one comes with lunch. They both come with t-shirts. So it's just kind of fun. It's just another way to people to kind of step up and give back, you know, because the donations and the profits on that stuff do go to the food bank and to the Warming Center. So if you want to check it out, just go to AmericanHauntings.net. Everybody always complains there's nothing to do in the wintertime. Well, here it is. And we'll actually have working heat this year because we will not be having it at the Mineral Springs. So, it'll be a good time. So hope to see all of you there.
Can I tell you real quick before we move on too far? Devil's Carnival, number one new release in circus performing arts.
No kidding. Yeah. Oh, I didn't even know that. Well, I'll be darned.
Currently number eight in bestsellers of circus performing arts. So that's awesome. And is it?
Well, I mean, probably not that many circus books.
Hey, we're not going to look at the total.
But out of five, you know.
Is it true? This says on Amazon 540 pages. Is that about right?
Yeah, it is. Wow. Yeah, it's a big one. Yeah, it's very
heavy. That's awesome. Yeah. Who did the cover art?
April.
It was April again?
April always does the cover arts. Yeah. Yes, she does a great job.
So cool.
Yeah, she did this one. I think she kind of topped everything she'd done before.
Yeah.
With this one, it's very cool.
That's so cool. I can't wait. Awesome. You have anything else coming up that we didn't talk about yet? Or
no, I think that's it for now. I mean, that's where we are right now. I mean, you know, we got all the events and stuff already posted all the way up through June. So people are starting to make their reservations for events, you know, later in the winter and the spring. We got a lot of good stuff, new things coming up. So
awesome. Yeah,
a lot of fun.
Did you get my note about my request for my vendor table?
Yeah, far away from creepy dolls. I think that's kind of impossible, unfortunately.
That's a good point.
Yeah, when it comes to the conference, a lot of creepy dolls.
It's not just you.
No, it's not just me and my little guy who hangs out at my table. It's all over the place. So, I mean, you don't want to be anywhere near Carrie. She's got a doll orphanage down there at Carrie Bergen's. Yeah, she won't be the only one either, I'm sure. So
I just can't escape them. Croy, I put up my Christmas tree yesterday. It's an all-black Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And I came up with a new saying, it's gothing around the Christmas tree.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Thank you.
I've got a white one in the museum, but it's got all black ornaments on it.
I love that.
Like Krampus, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I love it. I'm still trying to figure out. I don't have anything on mine, and I'll only put like white lights on it, kind of the opposite. But
I know. That's me too. Yeah.
Trying to figure out if I want to put anything on top. I used to have a creepy Amish doll with no face that I'd put on top. I gotta figure that out. So if you have any suggestions, anybody?
Yeah.
I wanted to give. Speaking of, you know, new seasons and things like that, I wanted to give a shout out to our latest subscribers on Patreon. So thank you so much for supporting the show and subscribing. Thanks to Rachel, Jennifer, Diana, Marie, Jamie, Amy, Tabor, Kelly, Adam, Brian, Christopher, Andrea, Joe, and Craig. So
nice.
That's awesome.
Nice.
Thank you for signing up.
Yeah, they have been really great too with, you know, all the stuff that's happened with the Facebook page and the bank account and all that stuff. The Patreon people have been not only super supportive because they're supportive every month, but they've been great about sharing stuff. So that I want to thank everybody once again for that. But with the Patreon program, we've got four full seasons of an alternate podcast for you to binge. And as I mentioned, season five will be coming very soon. I'm still not letting people know. You'll know when the teaser gets posted, and then we'll share that around. But you know, it's every other week. That one goes up, so it can fit into the regular run of the show, so that you've got a new episode every week. So you check it out if you can, if you're willing to get involved in that. Just go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Awesome. Well, I want to dive into a listener review real quick.
Okay.
This one is from Trevor Ha or Trevor H-A. I don't know. It's capitalized. I'm just going to say Trevor Ha because it's funny. It's titled Amazing.
Literally Ha.
Right? Well, yes. Yeah. So Trevor says, this is the most interesting podcast. I love the podcast and how it explores the haunted history of different cities and how they found what is the truth and what is legend. And I think that's very appropriate for the episode that we're going to end this season on.
Yeah. Yeah. I saved this one to the end. I mean, not only because it fit chronologically as far as December, where you know, it kind of wraps up, but or kicks off, I guess, really. But yeah, just because it seemed like a good one to wait until the end.
Absolutely. So yeah, let's dive into this story. And there's something that you didn't really, everybody knows some story about Amityville Horror, right? They at least know the name.
Sure.
And so I wanted to ask, back up real quick. I forgot to say, it's my mother's birthday today, first birthday without her. I want to say, hey, happy, you know, heavenly birthday after whatever they do.
Yeah. Afterlife birthday.
Yeah, sure.
Which doesn't even make sense. But I know. We can roll with that.
Ricky texted me this morning. He's like, make sure you smoke a bunch of cigarettes and drink Mountain Dew for mom's birthday today. She would love it. Casty goes, well, I can't do either of those. And I was like, Casty, you are being selfish right now.
Yeah, right.
I
drank some Mountain Dew for her, although I've got to stop drinking.
Perfect.
Halloween is over.
I grabbed a soda the other day, just a normal bottle of Dr. Pepper, and I started going through 128% of the recommended sugar you're supposed to have.
Oh, I know.
I was like, what? I was like, no wonder I'm gaining weight. I'm grabbing Humdingers left and right. Anyway, on to less depressing stuff. Somehow. So everybody knows some kind of a version of this and everything. But one thing, if it was in your outline, I missed it, but was Butch, was it, I'd always heard heroin and LSD. Do you know the crazy cocktails this guy was doing?
I know that there were a lot of drugs involved. Mm-hmm. Whether or not he was actually high at the time of the murders or not, I don't know. I'm not sure anyone can say for sure. I mean, there's so much misinformation out there anyway, but even, you know, going back to the crime case, I don't think everything was ever completely divulged in that either, because he had so many different stories. I mean, the one thing about the crime part of it, just the murders themselves, that have always been so strange is how in the world with this, you know, Marlin high-powered rifle, how did no one hear these shots?
Yes,
that's the one thing that's always baffled me. And I'm not saying it's anything supernatural. I'm just saying it's so weird. You know, it's just so bizarre. I mean, why didn't it wake up anyone else in the house? I mean, so the neighbors, maybe. Although I would have thought in a nice neighborhood like this, I mean, man, if somebody, you know,
it's a loud gun
these days, they're, you know, they've got it on Ring and Next Door and everything else. Oh, those are gunshots. And, you know, but I know it's different these days, but I mean, you're talking about a pretty nice neighborhood here, town, nice, quiet neighborhood. And if there are gunshots going off at 3 o'clock in the morning, you would have thought someone would have heard it, but okay, maybe not, but inside the same house, in the same room, I don't know, man, it's weird.
And that is concluded by the, I guess, position of the bodies, the fact that nobody was really out of bed so much.
They're still exactly where they were, and some of it is, you know, oh, she woke up and looked at me. That's coming from Butch. So who knows? But I mean, it seems possible.
Do we know if they, I'm not sure just because of the time period, but did they do like tox screens on people? Could he like drugged them heavily or anything?
I don't know. I've never run across anything like that, that he might have. I don't know how he would have.
Yeah.
But I suppose, I mean, it could have been done, I suppose. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I've never seen any mention of anything like that. I mean, I could have missed it, but
sure, I haven't either, but I'm sure I think of ways to
I mean, just... I did not go back and reread the book.
Yeah, no.
Before I did this, I'd read it already, and that was enough. You know,
right.
I didn't go back and reread it. So before I wrote this,
because I can understand, one or two people maybe not waking up, moving or something, but this is, it's too many and too
well, and then like the shooting one of each, one boy, one of the brothers in one room and one of the sisters in another, and yet the other one didn't wake up or didn't at least try to escape. You know what I mean? But
yeah, it's bizarre.
It didn't happen. So it's weird.
I mean, yeah, I guess if you're a really quick shot, but then that doesn't explain.
Not really.
The other rooms. Yeah. It's bizarre. One of those things we won't know. It's crazy. It's a sad story. There's actually, I think I've told you about this before, but I've been getting into video games lately. Just it randomly happened, but years ago, before I was really into them at all, I was at a friend's house and he's like, hey, can I show you this scary game? And I was like, absolutely, you can show me a scary game. And it was called PT. And I'm reading a little bit about it now. And it's not claiming to be anything about Amityville, but the storyline seems pretty lined up. But it's basically a game where you keep walking around a house and you have a weapon. And it's supposed to be right after Butch committed these murders. And so you keep going through the same house, but every time you go around, crazier shit keeps happening each time.
Uh-huh.
And it's scary.
But so you're like Butch?
Yes, you're Butch.
Okay, that sounds like a horrible game.
It's
terrifying. Why would you want to be that to be your character?
Well, so that's the thing, is they don't claim to Amityville. It's just it's a guy that just committed.
Okay, well, that makes me a little less nauseated, but still weird.
Oh yeah, it's very
pass.
Weird. Yeah, pass. It's very weird.
Not that I play video games anyway, but pass.
Right. So. It's very weird. And I have to mention, just because I know there's different books and movies, renditions of that, but you know, my good friend Ryan Reynolds in one of them. CodyBeck.com.
I will tell you that I did rewatch that Amityville.
Yeah.
Just for fun. It popped up on, I don't know, I was just scrolling through something, looking for something to watch one night, and it popped up and I went, you know what, I'm gonna rewatch that. And it's really, I mean, it's not, obviously, it's even further away from the book than the original film was. But it's also like, when you look at the real life people, mm-hmm. and then you look at Ryan Reynolds and is it Melissa George that's in it? And you're thinking, no, no.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds with his six pack abs with his shirt off. And I'm thinking, I don't think in the 70s, there was a lot of people who looked like that, but I can tell you that George Lutz did not look like that.
Right.
So yeah, at least it's a little less, I don't know. It's a little more entertaining than the original. The original's pretty bad, but
yeah.
You say it's dated, but it's like, well, it's the time period. I mean, it fits.
Right.
I mean, it was filmed, you know, a couple of years after the book came out. And, you know, I think James Brolin and Margot Kidder fit the real life people a little better than Ryan Reynolds does.
So. Sure. Yeah, you know, good friend. Yes. But so there's a few things I wanted to ask about then. I think we can kind of separate these out. I'd like to talk about why Butch would have done this. And it seems pretty evident. But I want to know, because I know you said, you know, you can't really prove all these things and you don't, not sure exactly what to believe and what not to believe. There might be, but as far as why Butch did this, it seems pretty cut and dried, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously he was, I mean, you know, why does anybody do this? I mean,
greed.
That's a good question. It happens a lot. And unfortunately, family annihilators are usually fathers. And usually it's not for the reasons that you might think. I mean, it's normally a case of shame. At least that's what the psychiatric journals all say. And I think we talked about that before. But in this case, I think that he, for whatever reason, thought he could get away with murdering his entire family, and then he'd be the one who inherited the money that his father had and the dealership and stuff, and that he could get away with it by saying, you know, I mean, remember that Godfather had only come out a couple of years before, so people were really hot on this gangster stuff, and him going around saying, ah, yeah, my dad was involved in organized crime. It was a hitman, man, took him out. You know, dad was laundering money for the mafia, you know, come on, you know, but I don't know. It must have seemed legitimate to this dumb.
Yeah.
But yeah, it didn't. It took them all of about an hour to figure out that, well, this ammunition here, you know,
yeah,
that
he's got
with all of his guns. Now, and like I said in my story, is that this was him having all those guns was problematic in so many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a guy with lots and lots of mental issues. Now, not insanity. I'm never going to say that he was even remotely insane.
Nope.
But he had the kind of mental issues that people should not own guns.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no red flag laws, you know, of any kind back then. I mean, not that, and we need more now, let's be honest, because nuts like this still have them. But on the other hand, you know, why his parents thought it was okay for him to have all these guns is also a little beyond me. But, you know, it didn't take him long to figure out who done it. You know, his stories didn't really hold up. But I honestly, I think that's the reason why. You know, I mean, I know he trial, they tried to say it was self-defense and all kinds of stuff. And he tried to pretend to be crazy and, you know, and then, you know, the devil made me do it stuff and all that. You know, so
yeah. I have two questions. You might have mentioned one of them. How old was Butch when this happened? Do you know?
Yeah, he was. Gosh, let's see.
I can figure it out.
Yeah, I'd have to do the math here. I want to say early 20s, but I don't remember.
That's what I thought.
I off the top of my head, I can't give you an exact number, but I'd have to do the math on the dates. And if you've got it in front of you, you can do the math.
He was 23. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I thought early 20s. He was still pretty young. I mean, technically, you know, he's 2 years over drinking age, but he'd already been drinking for a long time. I mean, his parents gave him a speedboat when he was like 14, yeah. You know, just to pacify him, you know? So, I mean, I'm not going to say they didn't cause this. They didn't, but they maybe should have come up with, well, his mom did try other ideas. I mean, mm-hmm. She sent him to psychiatrists and stuff, but you know, he's antisocial behavior. You know, I think that really sum things up the way that the psychiatrists from the state said at trial. You know, he's not crazy, but he definitely has got some problems.
Yeah, so. he was not crazy. The fact that he then took the gun and hid that stuff and came up with the story,
exactly.
And went to work and calling the house.
Yeah, and pretended like, you know, everything was, oh boy, I'm really concerned. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The second question I wanted to ask, and you might have, again, you might have mentioned this, but I've heard different things. Was there even any evidence at all of his father being involved in any mafia type stuff?
No, nothing like that. And, you know, and as I said at the beginning, you know, there were all these rumors about how abusive his dad was and stuff. But, you know, again, the only person's word we have for that is Butch. And so you can't take that with any kind of, you know, proof of anything.
Right.
And no one else ever reported anything like that. I just think it was probably, you know, 1970s, you know, parental stuff. And, you know, considering his parents gave him anything he wanted to and didn't press charges when they knew he stole that money.
Yep.
And stuff. I think that a big part of that was just him coming up with some excuse, mm-hmm. You know, kind of a Menendez brothers kind
right.
of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And
you know, I'm no expert on any of this stuff, but I don't know exactly how it goes, but I would think as far as, you know, abusing people, eventually the father would get tired of abusing the grown man and maybe move to anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. If you think back to our Charlie Lawson story.
Yes.
Speaking of family annihilators.
Yes.
You know, there was the one son that he sent away. Yeah, he knew he couldn't do it anymore. Buck was just too big. And I think this probably became the same thing. I mean, I've seen photos of the two of them together. And, you know, Butch was just as big as his dad was, bigger probably mm-hmm. than his dad was. And his dad was quite a bit older. You know, it was a different time. You had kids a little later sometimes, you know, and mm-hmm. And he definitely was a grown man. So
right.
I have trouble believing that that was the reason for it. I think mm-hmm. it was just he'd gotten this twisted idea into his head that he was going to end up with all the family's money and he didn't care what happened to anybody else in the family.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact that he killed his mother and his brothers and sisters is just, I mean, talk about sick, you know, I mean, that's just really messed up.
Yeah. It's so fucked up. Yeah. You're mad at your dad and you take it out all over. And I would imagine at that age, and once we know what he's capable of, if he's on drugs and drinking and all this stuff, if he would have fought his dad back at some point,
sure,
I would have gone crazy and it would have been a thing. But anyway, Dr. Daniel Schwartz testified. You said later testified in the Son of Sam case, eh?
Uh-huh. Same guy.
Yeah. You know. So that's interesting. Butch is eventually found guilty on 6 counts of second degree murder. It seems like, okay, he didn't, maybe he didn't plan it, but he had plans for afterwards.
But I also think that that might have been something to do with pleading down to get first degree would have earned him the death penalty.
Right.
Second degree wouldn't. And that might, I think that believe that had something to do with it.
Right. So. And it still keeps him in jail for, you know,
ever.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Who never got out.
That makes sense. And then, okay, the Lutz family buys the home for $80,000. I didn't look at,
I mean, that's still a decent amount of money. Don't get me wrong. But it's still a lot less than it should have been for a town on Long Island, especially Amityville, which was, you know, kind of an upper, you know, one of the upper wealthier, you know, suburbs of New York out on Long Island. And with the house, the size that it was, the amount of acreage, the boathouse, et cetera, it was a really good deal.
80K is about 348.
Yeah. Today. So, I mean,
that's not including,
I guarantee you that that piece of property is way over $1 million today.
Yeah.
Way over. So that's really cheap for that area.
Right. Yes. And so, then that makes sense. Okay. So there's like two different things now I want to talk about to finish this out, but they're going to kind of intertwine.
Yeah. Basically, well, they have to, because there's
family and the Warrens.
As I said, there is this, the last part of this story has like, you know, three side trips and two competing stories going the entire time. So
yeah,
it gets a little confusing, but it's all there. But right. I thought it was important to, this is going to be the last time I plan to ever talk about the Warrens on our podcast.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So that's my plan, is to never bring them up again. And certainly, you know, I thought I would get it all out.
Yes. Yeah.
Know, with stories that happen around the same time. You know, right. I mean, there are plenty of other absolutely ludicrous things that happened with the Warrens in the years that followed Amityville. But coming up to Amityville, some of the big ones was, of course, the Conjuring story.
Right. Know. Right. And you know, the Warrens, we were not fans. And it's almost like, you know, there is a thing we've talked about where, you know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. But it's almost like never let a monetization opportunity
get in the way of a true story. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. So the Lutz family is in on this with DeFeo's attorney. But were the Warrens also in on that, or do they just do their Warren thing?
No, they jumped in afterward like they always do.
They just
kind of like they did with the Enfield Horror, which made the Conjuring 2. So if anybody's ever seen that movie, what you need to know, just in a nutshell, is that the Warrens were actually at that house for an afternoon.
That's it.
And so nothing that you see in that movie happened with them there. It was all other investigators. So that's just the movie.
Are there?
Yeah, that's all I was going to say. So. So they kind of jumped in afterward just to try to, because it was a big deal. Mm. You know, it was a huge deal. And I guess that, George was calling around people and somehow got a hold of the Warrens, and they decided to, you know, to do this. They got news people interested and showed up at the house for that seance.
Mm-hmm.
And,
they're good at what they did.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, and again, they were still, you know, early on, they were the only game in town. So when they started, there wasn't anybody else. So after 15, 20 years of this nonsense, with nobody ever able to prove anything otherwise, they were pretty well known. And so by the 70s, having them involved, that put a mark on this thing that it must all be absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew any better in the 70s.
Yeah. Regarding the second Conjuring movie, are any of the recordings that you can still find online of the little girl talking, is any of that legitimate at all?
All that was done by investigators from the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research in England. Mm-hmm. Guy Playfair was the guy. He wrote a book called This House is Haunted. And so he was one of the main investigators, along with Morris Gross. They were the ones. There were others involved too, but they were the two leads on that. And there's actually a film that was done. It was actually a several part series done on A&E a few years ago. You can still find it. I think it's on Hulu now, but it's just The Enfield Haunting, I think. And it's very good. And a little bit more, well, definitely more accurate than The Conjuring Part Two. But those recordings and things were legit. I mean, they were recorded during that. Now, whether or not the entire haunting was legit, I don't know. You know, that there was a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of speculation as far as whether or not these girls hoaxed some of that stuff. And, you know, but if they did, then they would have had to have fooled a couple of people who were very experienced at this stuff. And Guy Playfair wrote a whole book about it, and I've heard him interviewed, and he, you know, he's since passed away, but I heard him in an interview just a few years ago before he died. And he was talking about, you know, the case, and he honestly believed there was something to it. But yeah, the Warrens didn't have any part of it at all. He said that when they showed up that afternoon, he was there, and that Ed Warren took him aside and told him, man, you know how much money you could make from this. And that was his entire interaction with the Warrens. So, yeah, anyway.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to check out that book, 'cause it's interesting. And the thing that always draws me in, and it's so hard to tell, especially nowadays, what you should even give the time of day to as far as recordings or this or that versus not. But when children do stuff like,
yeah, I know,
super crazy deep voice or whatever, it's like that gets my attention at least, you know, but I can entertain an idea without necessarily believing it. But yeah, so basically there's money to be made around a lot of this stuff. Did the Warrens ever go to a case and just be like, there's nothing here? Or was it kind of like, there's no money to be made here? So
that would be my guess. I mean, I can't speak for sure, but I'd say that was probably a good part of it, you know, because I mean, nothing that happens in the first Conjuring movie involving Ed and Lorraine turned out to be legitimate. I mean, nothing from, you know, what she claimed the ghost was that was haunting the house to anything else, because, you know, eventually Roger just kicked them out of the house and told them not to come back. So, you know, it all ended without them involved. And of course, then they, of course, blame the fact that the house was still haunted on the parents because, well, it must be their fault. Couldn't be theirs. Couldn't be Ed and Lorraine's. You know?
That's why I'm about the faith thing. I was like, that's why you're cursed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is pretty much the last part that I have, but yeah, talking about ghosts or anything like that, talk about traumatic history, you know, of a house.
Well, yeah, that's what I always say. I mean, you know, there's no reason to think the house couldn't. It could have been haunted. It might have even have been. Maybe that's the things that George and Kathy were experiencing, you know, the fact that it was, you know, something left over there from the murders that had happened. But, you know, if that's the case, it seems like it eventually faded away because nobody after them, you know, ever had any experiences there. And, you know, George and Kathy would maintain, and later, you know, Kathy passed and then George was still around and he did backtrack some and say, well, you know, it wasn't quite, you know, as much as was in the book, you know, because by then everybody knew the story, you know, I mean, they knew, you know, William Weber was out there just, you know, just, yeah, we made the whole thing up over spaghetti and wine, you know, and so it's
so,
you know, it's kind of hard to take it seriously after that. But, you know, he tried because I think that, you know, you don't, when you get, it's just like with the Warrens, you get that deep into it. Can you really just let it go?
Right.
I mean, the Warrens couldn't because they had money riding on it. And really, so did George, because, you know, what if somebody came back and said, hey, all that money, you know, that book wasn't true. You're going to have to pay that back. You know, I don't know that could be done, obviously, but still, you know, it probably crossed his mind at some point. I don't know.
So. Yeah. What do you think? I'm sure we've talked about this before, but it's been a long time at least. But what do you think it is about traumatic history and things like that where, say, where even if there is a haunting or whatever, some will fade or some don't, or some take longer to fade, or some just don't ever stick, you know? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's anybody, well, I don't think anybody really knows for sure. Just lots of theories out there. But I think that in a lot of cases, depending on the amount of trauma and how much stuff remains behind, and, you know, it may have something to do with the location itself. I mean, some places are going to be much more prone to maybe hanging on to that energy than others would, you know, maybe a place with, you know, natural stone or water
about rocks
or something.
And
right. Maybe that soaks it up more like a battlefield. But of course, on a battlefield, you know, sure, it was bad that all of those members of that family, was six people died in that house. But on a battlefield where 50,000 people die, that's going to stick around a little longer, you would think. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I think I can't say one way or the other if the High Hopes house was ever really haunted. But if it was, it had the potential to be. And if it really was, it seems like it was something that just was some trauma that stuck around and replayed itself for a while and then just kind of faded on. And again, there's no way to know exactly how or why it all works, but
that's the fun part.
I know. Right. But that would make sense, you know, but I don't know. All the stuff that they recounted and claimed obviously didn't really happen. I mean, there's evidence of these things that didn't happen. You know, it's hard when you going around and saying, I'm going to guess Jay Anson, when he wrote this thing, just went by what, I mean, I don't know anything about him, but he went by what he was told. And probably applied some drama to it. So when he's talking about doors being blown off their hinges and ripping apart the woodwork, and then people go to the house and it's like, there's nothing wrong with these doors.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of stuff that it's the little things like that get you into trouble with stories like that. You know, I don't know, man. It's one of those things that, we, you know, as I said in the story, we focus so much on what didn't happen. We forget about what might have happened.
Sure.
So I don't think we can say one way or the other, but it is interesting to think about that there might have been something to the story in the end. I don't know.
Yeah. I like to think that I have a couple thoughts now. If somebody's just completely bullshitting something, like it seems like kind of disrespect, knowingly bullshitting something, you know, it seems very disrespectful. That might be a reason for me to be like, no, I'm coming back and I'm going to.
Right.
And the other thing is, I wonder if it has anything to do with, you know, whether something sticks around or not too, the people that are around to potentially interact with it, you know, and their emotional states, and if it's something, something could feed off of or not, you know, to maybe stick around for a little bit, or I, you know, talking about my ass here, but I'm just
kidding. Yeah, right. I know what you mean.
And I thought it was interesting. And I know that we're the morbid curious, you know, I don't want to say we're just as guilty, because I've thought about this a lot, and I know you have a ton of experience with this, but the family ends up, you know, changing the address and getting rid of the famous windows and stuff, because people are just, they're not thinking, hey, there's a different real family that lives here.
Yeah. Well, and I know, and that's the problem. There's a difference between, you know, being curious about a place and driving by, maybe taking a picture of it. And then there's going up, knocking on the doors and standing in the yard and everything else and blocking traffic and, you know, which is what was going on.
Yeah.
So that's how all the neighbors ended up calling them, which is awesome. The Amityville Horribles. I just love that. Which is, it's just so funny, but not funny to them, obviously not funny to the people who live there. And so people don't think about that. And we've talked, and how many times have we talked about crime scenes where there's, you know, 100 people standing around? You know, I always go back to the Villisca season, and every crime scene had people standing around, you know, wandering through the house, picking shit up, and, you know, and you're thinking, man, what what the hell?
Right.
You know, so
I totally support standing behind police tape.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but don't potentially ruin, you know, an investigation or anything because you want a cool rock or some shit.
Right, Right.
So, oh man. Well, hey, that's all I had for this. I'm trying to think if there's anything else Warren related I want to talk about while you have the last.
Well, I say that, and then I'm sure they'll probably pop up again somewhere. But
right.
But yeah, I don't ever plan on featuring them quite as heavily as I did in this episode.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
And it's, we don't like, inaccurate history and stuff. But again, we also just don't like people that take advantage of other people in a, at their lowest points or bad, thing when shit like this kind of happens. And the Warrens have no problem.
They justify
the means sort of
thing. I think so, too.
Yeah. All right. Well, it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Gmail.com. Yeah.
Sorry, I haven't read this in years. It's off the top of the dome. But, yes. But this message comes to us from Ian, and Ian writes, "Hi, Cody and Troy. Greetings from across the pond. I have a quick question for you both. Do you have a list of reportedly haunted places in the UK that you'd like to visit? And would you consider doing a special on some of them? I love the podcast and discovering the historical aspect of lesser known crimes and haunts. Hope you guys have a wonderful Thanksgiving." So this is a while ago. And I hope to make my way to Alton at some point. It's on my bucket list. Thanks to your podcast. Keep up the awesome work. Stay spooky. Ian, I know it's American Hauntings. What do you think?
And I would really feel uninformed. Trying to do too much with anything. And not having been there ever.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of tough. I mean, yeah, of course there are things I would like to do and things I'd like to see. And, one of these days, I'll have an answer for that, a better answer for it. Yeah. I've read a lot of books and things, but I've never read, or haven't been to the places. So I kind of, leaves me out.
I hadn't really thought of that. With the places that you typically write about, is a big part of it physically visiting it at least?
Well, I like to try to go to places when I can. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I've written about, I mean, there every once in a while there'll be some place that, the story's great, but I can't, I haven't been there. But I try to do that as much as I can. I mean, I've traveled a lot over the years. And so a lot of places I may not get around to writing about for 10 or 15 years after I've been there, but I try to always go and have been there. And so it would be hard for me to write it. And it doesn't matter how much British TV I watch. I don't think that counts.
Right. I got you. Well, I know you've traveled a lot. I know there's some places that have creeped you out a little bit. And sure. I think about the Bellwitch and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any place that due to not just because you think it's not worth your time, but is there any place that you just would not go again because you're like, nope, I've had my fill, like, hell no, not again?
No, not really. I don't think I've ever been anywhere that, scared me so badly I wouldn't go back.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there have been places that I've gone, okay, well, I've done this once. I don't need to go back here again. I'm sure many of those. But,
yeah, right.
But as far as a place I've been that, scared me so much I wouldn't go back, no.
Mm-hmm. Not so much.
No, not really.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, because I always tell people when they ask about Alton and stuff, I'm like, yeah, First Unitarian Church. I'm like, that's the place that, it unsettles me the most. They're like, would you go back if you could? I was like, oh, yeah, hell yeah.
Well, yeah, anytime. Yeah,
of course
right,
I would.
Right. So
absolutely. that's awesome. Well, thank you, Ian, for the question. Do you get any messages from the?
Oh, yeah, I always do. Yeah.
Let's hear them.
Yeah. So if you guys have a comment or a question that you want to ask, you can send it to us by text. Sometimes that's even easier to reach us. And that is on the Haunt Line. And the number for that is 217-791-7859. And you'll either get a reply or you'll get it read on the show. I do both. Sometimes it's one or the other. Sometimes it's both. You just never know. So, but I do have a few things here for both of us. So let's see. This first one comes from Eddie in the 678. It says, "Hey, Troy, sorry to hear about what happened to your business." Oh, small. Well, there are some real scumbags out there. Yeah, there are. So anyway, he's just being nice. But thank you guys for putting on a fantastic podcast. You guys are the best. Do you think John Wayne Gacy would have continued killing if he hadn't have been caught? Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no question. Yes, he did run out of space in the crawl space,
right?
And started dumping him in the river. But I think because of that, it was a matter of time. I mean, yeah. He was going to get caught. And I'm sure he probably knew that at some point he was going to get caught. But, you know, deep down would be my guess. But yeah, I definitely think he would have kept going if he had, you know, had the opportunity to do it. So
did Gacy, I don't know, we didn't talk about this so much. Did he do things like some of them do, like wanting to get caught, you think, or just
normally? I don't know. I just think he really got sloppy.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I just think that he just sort of deteriorated to the point that he just wasn't trying not to as hard not to get caught anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, he'd been doing it for so long and getting away with it that he was just, I don't know, just, but I also think he was sort of kind of breaking down a bit too.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, how does that not, well, I don't know. I guess if you're a monster,
that's the thing. You're a non-monster. I know,
it seems like one of those things that would eventually get to you, but apparently not. Not after 33. If it hadn't got to you by then, it's probably not going to, I suppose. So,
right.
Anyway, so this one comes to us from Karen in the 410. She says, "Hey, Tori and Cody, I am rewatching Penny Dreadful." Remember that? That's a good series.
Yeah.
"And heard a character mention the Pinkerton agency. Was this the same agency involved in the Villisca investigation? It sounded familiar, made us think of you guys. If you haven't already, Penny Dreadful is a show you might enjoy." It is a good show. Yep. And yes, those are the same Pinkertons. The Pinkerton Detective Agency was really the preeminent detective agency in the United States in the 19th century, the latter part of the 19th century. Robert Pinkerton. That didn't even sound right. Anyway, he started out investigating some things for Lincoln. It was part of kind of getting the Secret Service started. And then after the war, they were involved. He was based out of Chicago, and they sent people after Jesse James and all the, you know, they were hired by companies that would send them out looking for outlaws and bandits and things. And they did a lot of really disreputable stuff. After the founder passed away,
Alan
Pinkerton, damn, I don't know where I kept getting Robert. Anyway, well, there were others. Oh, there was another Pinkerton detective agency that had nothing to do with, it's really funny. Actually, I wrote a book about
Edward Rucker. I'm sorry. That was the attorney guy.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Oh, but well, you said Robert. Never mind.
Yeah. I got confused. There was another Pinkerton detective agency. I wrote that book about the murders in Austin, the midnight killer that was, and they thought they were hiring the Pinkertons, and they hired a different Pinkerton, and he was like a phony, and he came down and didn't solve anything. But it was not hilarious story because people were being murdered, but it was still kind of funny. But they got involved in labor disputes and things, and usually on the side of the industrial people, and were out like breaking the legs of strikers and
the homestead strike,
murdering them and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, they really got a bad reputation after like opening fire on awful.
With the homestead strike, there is a Robert E. Pattinson, who's the governor of Pennsylvania.
I just got confused.
It's fine.
It's my fault. So
I know we talked about some of the stuff you would have liked to do. Would have been working for the Pinkertons one of your like kind of dream job sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah? The Pinkertons. Oh, okay. Awful.
Well, I mean, like something like that, or did you want to do some? Because you talked about wanting to be some sort of like gumshoe sort of thing back in the day.
Oh, well, whatever. Yeah, that would be fun, but not for the Pinkertons.
I just meant something similar. But anyway, okay.
Sure, maybe. I don't know.
Right.
You know, if it'd been the 30s, I wanted to be a bank robber. So that doesn't, I mean, that's the opposite side of the law. So, all right. So this one comes to us from our friend Bob, who texts us frequently, and he is a frequent texter. And I always enjoy getting texts from him because they're usually funny.
Thanks, Bob.
I don't read all of them on the podcast. Because we can't. But anyway, hey, just listen to the most recent podcast. Very good. As an aside, did you know that Garth Brooks wrote a song about John Wayne Gacy?
No.
Now, I saw this, but I purposely did not look it up just because I didn't figured that you would look it up while we were talking about it. But now I wonder if this was one of his Chris Gaines songs or something, because I can't imagine why Garth Brooks would have a song about John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah.
But I suppose anything is possible. Do you find any information on that?
I'm seeing accusations about Garth Brooks. Let's see.
Oh, yeah. Garth Brooks being a serial killer. Yes. Yes. I have heard that. I think that's meant to be a spoof.
I think it is.
I don't think that's real. But I wasn't aware that he had written. So I assume you're Googling this, so I'm not going to. So, yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Well, Bob, you're going to have to follow up on that one because we have no idea what you're talking about. So if you follow it up with us, I'll make sure everyone knows. Yeah. And if somebody else knows, they can text us and let us know. Yeah, all right. So yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Something about St. Paul. It might be Papa loved Mama. I have to click through it. It finds something, but it's nothing. Nothing's just immediately like
you'd have to listen to all of Garth Brooks' music to
the whole discography.
So I'm never going to know. Honestly.
Yeah,
so,
well, let us know.
I don't hate Garth Brooks, but I'm not going to listen to all of it. So, right. All right. So this one comes to us from Chrissy in the 863. See, I told you what was going to happen with once we did that episode about Herb Baumeister and then we did John Wayne Gacy. I told you we're going to get a bunch of texts about Gacy then after we'd already gotten a bunch of texts about Gacy. So anyway, this is Chrissy here. I texted once before in regards to mine and Troy's mutual disdain for Star Wars prequels, and I still have that. Mm-hmm. I'm currently listening to the John Wayne Gacy episode for the second time. It's a favorite story / topic. See, And Troy said, quote, "This could have gone on for 6 more hours." And I said to myself, "Yes, please. I'll sign up for the director's cut."
That's awesome.
Yeah, I would not want to talk about that for 6 hours. I can't think of anything much more depressing than that. Okay, this one is that's the same one. This one is from Anonymous In from Las Vegas 951. "I love the podcast. Really wanted to meet you at your event in Vegas but couldn't make it." They're to talk about how much they love the podcast. "Thank you and Cody are some of the good guys out there I like to support. And I know, joke's on me. Ha ha." Just cracked me up. So that one I had to.
I love it.
And then here's our last one. This one comes to us from Melissa in the 847. "Hey, have a question. Are there any stories you researched that absolutely terrified you? Also," okay, this is two questions. "Have you ever experienced anything paranormal while researching, writing your podcast episodes, books? Love, love, love the show. Say hi to Cody."
Hi.
Well, I've had not necessarily things that I would say terrified me while I was researching them, but definitely bothered me. Like Cody, the one about the book that I did, you know, I Want to Come Home Tonight, mm-hmm. About the Lillian, that one really bothered me. That was one story. The Grimes sisters really bothered me. There have been others that just are, you know, unsolved that bother me just because I can't imagine what it must be like, especially people who disappear, what their families must feel like. Especially when I did Without a Trace 2, because those stories were a lot more recent. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of those stories where those people could still be out there lost. I mean, I know they're all out there still lost, but it was a lot more recent than maybe the first book, which was more historical. The only time I've ever had anything that I would consider to be paranormal or unexplained that it happened during the time I was writing a book was both times really that I did the St. Louis Exorcism book. I talk about that at some of the presentations I've done, the dinners I've done about that, that's really the only time I've ever had anything weird happen. And both times it was things that were happening in a house that was never considered haunted. I had things disappear and show up in different places, stuff that had never been, you know, anything like that that had been happening in the house before that. And suddenly now it was. And I don't know how to, you know, say, do I think it was some sort of demonic activity? Not really. Probably something that I was doing without even realizing it. And I don't mean misplacing things. I mean, you know, I mean, I think we all have the possibility of weird things happening. And I often wonder if I didn't cause it myself. But yeah, I've had some weird things happen. We, you know, had, you know, I had a dinner where I was just the only time it's ever happened to me. I was using a cordless microphone that caught on fire while talking about The Exorcist. I also had part of a ceiling collapse not long ago during a talk about The Exorcist. So I don't know, man. It's one of those things that I prefer things not happen while I'm working on stuff. Just as a preference, if I get to choose, I'm going to choose no on that. So anyway, so yeah, so I hope that answers your question. So anyway, guys, if you do have a question or comment or whatever you want to send us, you can do so on the hotline. The number is 217-791-7859. And by the way, just as a last reminder, we'll be announcing the podcast listener of the year in our next week's show. So yes, if you've got anybody you want to nominate, this is your last chance to do so. We've been kind of adding things up and looking things over. And if we've missed something, please let us know. And we will definitely put it into consideration. So,
yeah, I have my spreadsheet and everything. And yeah, calculating who you all think should get the award, earn the the prestigious sought after listener.
That's right. Yeah, right. Yeah, which you get absolutely nothing.
Yes. So, the points are made up. Nothing matters. This episode of the American Onyx podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor. And it was produced.
Well, or I could just thank everybody for listening to the show first, since I didn't do that. And hope that they'll share it with their friends and neighbors and everyone that they know. And if they listen to us because they hate us,
jump the gun.
It still counts. You can reach us via email. You can drop us a text on the hotline, or you can check us out on social media. Cody and I are on Facebook. I had to start a brand new page after the last one got hacked, but it is there. It's Troy Taylor's American Oddities Museum. That's how you find it. I'm on Instagram. We do a little Blue Sky, a little Twitter, but you know, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when you're shopping for books, tours, events, or whatever at AmericanHauntings.net, and also at Cody's shirt store, which can also be linked from there, but it is AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use the code podcast there too, and you'll always get 10% off everything you order. Okay, now you can go ahead.
I'm so embarrassed. I jumped the gun. It was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, and maybe some other information if you're lucky.
Or unlucky.
Thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So, oh my gosh, I mean, we're going to have a bonus episode, but you know, until next season.
Still have one more show, technically. Right. I mean, it is our movie one. So it's technically not a regular episode, but
right.
Still, it is part of this season, I guess.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well,
one more.
Yeah, thanks for listening. So goodbye.
Next time. I can't even read. How about so long?
Yeah, there you go. We'll see you later.
See you later.
Oh man, we really just kind of trip at the finish line, don't we? That was
fun. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.